Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 268, and we're going to talk about digital nomadism, or the state of being a digital nomad, or, you know, we're just going to talk about it, and you'll learn something, I hope. We're also going to talk about testing polarity, not between people, but between wires. And we're going to have a product review of a solar panel that I have always said was bad, and now I have one, so I can tell you my experience. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I am in a tricky situation for recording here. I am in the Airstream that we have parked down on the river in north central Illinois, the Illinois Valley, as they call it. And if you haven't seen the interior of a modern Airstream, it looks very much like the outside. They've given up on all pretense of wallpaper or wall coverings or anything. It's just aluminum panels, which are very reflective, not only of light, but of sound. So I'm in a difficult recording situation. I also have the air conditioner running. So I apologize not only for this episode, but for recent episodes with all the sound problems I've been having. The reason for it is much more complicated than just the environment I'm in. The software I use has changed, and it's called Hindenburg. I've used it for years, but it's very much a locked hood kind of software where if something goes wrong, you can't open the hood to fix it. And I'm in a tough situation with that right now, specifically about volume leveling, which is the whole point one uses Hindenburg. Anyway, I apologize. I'm going to keep working on this. I will get it fixed. So this week I thought we'd talk about digital nomadism, and that's come up many times in the podcast, but I've never actually specifically addressed this idea of what it is. This is one of those well-described things. A digital nomad is somebody who is a nomad, a person who travels from place to place, who may or may not have a fixed home, but does spend a lot of time living in other places. It's the modifier that's interesting. It's the digital part. What the heck is digital about living in a van and driving around, for example? Well, the digital part refers specifically to this lifestyle that we can have now where you do not need to go to a place to do work. You do work online. And we've talked about remote work a lot, and the golden era of remote work may have passed us, or it may not. But an interesting aspect of the ability to be able to work remotely is, of course, you can work from wherever you are. And some countries, particularly countries that wish to bring in foreign dollars, have created a program called Digital Nomad Visas. And these are a special visa that allow people like you or me or whomever who meet certain criteria to live in the country legally. Now, if you're not familiar with the concept of visas and things like that, let's just go back a little bit. Every country is different, but basically, if you don't live in that country, you are allowed to go to that country based on certain things. And again, it's different everywhere. But let's say a tourist visa, which is the most common kind, those are usually good for 90 days. China has different things. Russia has different things. North Korea has completely different things. But generally, you're going to be good for 90 days. And you will need a passport in most cases. And then whether you need to actually fill out paperwork for that depends on where you're coming from. So, for example, in the U.S., if I wish to visit Mexico or the Bahamas or someplace like that, I don't need to fill out any paperwork. I automatically have a 90-day visa. Other countries are much more restrictive, like Brazil. At one time, Brazil, which has had a little bit of a war with the U.S. over this issue for years now, you had to send in a photograph of yourself to be allowed to go to the country in certain circumstances. Anyway, all that aside, all I'm trying to say is different countries have different requirements, and you need to do your research before you decide you want to go to another country. The digital nomad visa is a different thing than the tourist visa. The digital nomad visa gives you more rights and lets you stay for a longer period of time. Again, it's a country-by-country situation. But One of the restrictions of tourist visas in nearly every country that you go to is that you cannot work. And that usually means you cannot work in that country. And the idea being that, hey, you don't live here. You should not come here and take jobs away from the people who do live here. Our citizens deserve these jobs. So a tourist visa will prevent you from doing any kind of work in the country. And this has been kind of a huge problem for some people, like bands, especially. Like, a band goes on tour and then, well, hey, they're working in that country. Is that allowed? And there have been concerts canceled over this issue. It's a tricky thing. But the digital nomad visa gets you past that. If you meet the criteria of the digital nomad visa, you are allowed to work with restrictions. And generally, that restriction is that you must do remote work. So let's say you're self-employed. That's fine. Or maybe you just have a regular old job, but it's remote and the company is located in the United States. Well, you could go to Panama with a digital nomad visa and work there without breaking any of their laws about foreigners having jobs in the country. So that's the point of a digital nomad visa. There are other things like green cards and retirement visas and things like that. Those are completely separate. This is a fairly new phenomenon. And what I think is a good thing, it's a growing phenomenon. Digital visas are becoming more and more common, and I just saw that Slovenia now has a digital nomad visa. Now, where can you find a digital nomad visa? Like, the U.S. certainly doesn't have one. I don't believe Canada does. But here's a list of countries that do. And you have to consider this when I give you this list. I'm just going to read off a whole bunch of countries. Ask yourself why, and we'll talk about that on the other side. So in Europe, and this is not a complete list, this is just an example list. In Europe, you've got Spain, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Croatia, Estonia, Malta, Germany. And the nice thing about all these European countries is if you have a digital nomad visa in those countries, you also are in the Schengen zone. You have access to the Schengen zone, which means you can pretty much travel throughout Europe with no hassle. Again, with exceptions, everything's complicated, but that is a very valuable thing. To have a digital nomad visa, say from Portugal, which is frequently cited as one of the easiest countries to get one in, you can travel Europe to your heart's content without any worries at borders. You don't even have to stop. You just drive. It's fine. Now, some other countries in Europe also have digital nomad visas, like Bulgaria and Georgia, the country, not the state, Montenegro, Latvia, Albania, Cyprus, Serbia, Armenia, and North Macedonia. They're working on this. Now, those countries are in a different category than the Schengen countries. And yes, some of them are in the Schengen zone, but these are, to some extent, are considered developing countries, meaning they are growing, they're looking for new options. And, you know, for example, Montenegro is a fairly new country, a beautiful and wonderful country, I can say, because I have been there. And they're looking to establish themselves. And Latvia is not that dissimilar. Latvia had a really rough time in the 20th century. And again, a place I visited and a beautiful, wonderful place. I would absolutely live in Latvia for a while if I could. So different reasons than Spain and Portugal, but not all that different, really. They're basically trying to get people to go live there and spend their money there. North America has exactly one country that has any kind of digital nomad visa, and you may have guessed that it's Mexico. But Costa Rica, Panama, Belize, El Salvador is a tricky one. El Salvador is the only country I haven't visited in Central America, and boy, it doesn't look like I'm going to be getting there anytime soon. But yes, they also have digital nomad and temporary permit visas. Now, in Asia and the Middle East, there's a lot of options. You've got Indonesia, specifically Bali, Thailand, Japan, the UAE in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, South Korea, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Taiwan all have digital nomad options. And South America is growing in this regard too. We have Colombia, Brazil, Argentina, Ecuador, Peru, and Uruguay all have digital nomad visa programs. And again, what you're getting with this is legal residency, minimal or no income requirements, because a lot of time visas are tied to income, and you get access to local services. But you could go a little bit more exotic if you wanted to. For example, in the Caribbean and in other islands, you've got Barbados, Bermuda, which is interesting. Bahamas, Dominica, or Dominica, however you would like to pronounce that. Aruba, Antigua, not Antigua. Antigua is in Guatemala. Antigua is the island. Barbuda, which is halfway between Barbados and Bermuda, hence the name. Cayman Islands, Anguilla, Curacao, St. Lucia, Grenada, Puerto Rico, and Montserrat. Now, interesting about these, Curacao is in the European Union, and you could go there with a digital visa and potentially then have access to all of Europe or a lot of Europe. And then if you want to go even further, heck, Africa and Oceania, New Zealand, Australia region, they have programs too. South Africa, Mauritius, Seychelles, Namibia, Cape Verde, Egypt is kind of working on the idea. And while Australia and New Zealand don't have this, they are also working on some similar ideas. They're working on these working holiday or skilled visa ideas. All that said, who are these visas for and who are they not for? They are for people who want to go live for a year or so in a country that's not their own. That's what they're for. So they're great for young people who want to travel before they have any serious obligations in life. They're great for older people who don't quite meet the requirements of a retirement visa. Retirement visas always have financial requirements, and sometimes they're quite steep. And folks like that. But they are not for folks who are looking to find a new country to call home forever, because they generally do not lead to permanent citizenship. That's an entire thing. They also don't generally lead to permanent residency. So let's say that you go to Japan on a digital nomad visa, you have a great time, and you think, you know, I could live here. If you decide that, you then have to start all over and work on visas that lead towards residency. Again, every country has different requirements, but digital nomad visas typically are not for people looking for permanent residency. So keep that in mind. Now, the laws on these things change all the time, and I've been following the programs in Malta and a few other countries, and it just changes all the time. You basically have to go when you can. You can't count on this being here 5 years from now. Things change constantly. But if you're a person looking to travel the world with minimal hassles and have extended periods of time in a place, quite the opposite of a cruise. Cruises are like buffets. This is like a 9-course meal at one specific restaurant serving one kind of food. This might be a way for you to do that without having to play games like, oh, I got to leave the country for 2 weeks so I can come back and all that stuff. You can stay there usually a year, and then in many places you can reapply to stay another year. So this gives you the benefit to travel legally, but there are some cons to it. So let's talk of them very quickly. I mean, some of those cons are just associated with you going to live in another country. So those are fairly obvious. I want to speak specifically about the cons of the digital nomad visas. You have to stay up on the paperwork and the changing stuff, and you may encounter situations where folks don't really understand your visa. This will be especially true in the developing nations. I remember when yellow fever vaccines were no longer required in some African countries. Years later, some border guards were still demanding them, and you may run into that situation. Health insurance can be a problem if you're from a country that, like the U.S., that doesn't have universal health insurance, and you go to a country that does, you're probably going to have to pay for health insurance. Although, in my experience, this is much more affordable than it would be to try to do so in the U.S. And don't forget this one. Let's say, for example, that you have a good job with a company in the U.S. It's remote. They don't care where you are. They just want you to get your work done. And then you go be a digital nomad in Japan. Well, if your job is timed in that you have meetings to attend and things like that, your time zones aren't going to line up, and you're going to be working at 2 a.m. regularly. So don't forget that aspect. That is very important. And taxes can be tricky. I know in the U.S. that if you're a U.S. citizen, it doesn't matter where you live, you have an obligation to pay federal taxes to the U.S. government. So I knew some folks who worked in Afghanistan way back in the day, and they had to pay taxes to the U.S. government, even though none of the money they were earning was happening in the U.S. government, and they weren't using any direct U.S. governmental services while living in Afghanistan. So There's a lot to look into, but if you've not heard of this idea before, or if you've thought about it but didn't really think about it very much, here's an invitation to spend some more time thinking about it. I think that if I were, you know, a younger person with some flexibility and no real roots, this would be very appealing. And I know people who do this. I know some teachers who actually, they're from the U.S. They are very American, but they just move around and travel to different countries, and they'll spend a couple years in this country and a couple years in that country. And it's a very, very interesting life. It's not for everyone, but I think it is more for people who are drawn to van life than it is for just the general population. And a special thank you this week to Adventure Payments. These are some sailors who've been listening to the podcast and have bought me some gallons of whatever. In this case, the gallons they bought me were fresh water, as I'm living in a boondocking situation, and fresh water is very precious. So thank you very much. I really appreciate the support. And because of them and others like them, there are no ads in this podcast, and we're going to keep that going as long as we can. So if you would like to help keep this podcast ad-free and just help support the podcast in general, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And you can buy me a gallon of whatever you'd like or become a monthly donor, which is very much appreciated. And a special thank you to all the folks who do that. And that's it. No ads. Back to the podcast. Van life news. Okay, quick note here. This is not a podcast for talking about religion or politics, but I am a human being. I have politics and I have mostly lack of religion, but you know, I have these things. Just because I do a podcast where I try not to talk about them too much doesn't mean I don't have them. And we're in this situation now where politics is affecting van life in such a way that just reporting on normal van life news is talking about politics. And I don't like this situation, but somebody was a little concerned with me bringing up an issue about ICE and said, well, now you're talking about politics. And then they went into actually deep political opinion. And I'm sorry, that's just going to happen. There's nothing I can do about it. I have made my politics as clear as they need to be for this podcast. I'm an independent. I voted for Democrats and Republicans, and I am currently not in favor of the changes that are happening in the U.S. right now. So there you have it. I'm not trying to hide anything, but I also don't want to just, you know, harp on all these policies that I don't like or whatever, because there's lots of that going on, and that's not what we're about here. So with that said, please understand that I am picking these articles that I'm about to tell you about based on their impact on van life. And the fact that some of them involve politics is just the way it is. I am certainly not looking for political articles that happen to do with van life. It's quite the opposite. And first, I have to thank John, aka Hiker, for recommending a couple of these articles to me. That was very useful, and they're good articles. I'm going to start with what I think is good news, although it's a little complicated. So if you've been listening to my Tales from the Road, you have heard tales of my fights with my Sprinter van, which I can actually see out the window as it sits there immobile because it can't move. Yes, well, I did have a problem in that van where the diesel exhaust fluid froze. It froze in the tank. Now, the tank has a heater, but the van has to be running for that to happen. And my van was sitting for a while. It wasn't heated. The DEF froze. That means the DEF couldn't get to the engine. That means the engine said, hey, you don't have any DEF. And because of the law in the United States, it triggered something that the engine could only start 10 more times before it had to be taken to a dealership and reset, which costs money. On the 10th time, it would have killed the van. It wouldn't have let it start. Now, other vehicles do this a little different. Some enter into a severe limp mode, but this is a government requirement so that people don't cheat on the diesel exhaust fluid, which actually does work very well at cleaning the air coming out of the exhaust. To me, it's always seemed rather draconian. I mean, I understand cleaning the environment is in everyone's best interest. I am not opposed to EPA regulations. What I'm opposed to is the punishment for it, because there are legitimate cases where a sensor could fail. And given the nature of the sprinter, you could be many, 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 many miles away from help. And this requirement that you have to take it to a dealer to reset this because a sensor failed, or in my case, it just got cold, it seems ridiculous to me. And the good news is that might be changing. So the EPA, this was announced at a state fair just recently, as it happens. TheDrive.com is where this article came from. I'll have a link in the show notes. But the EPA has told truck makers to knock it off. They're not getting rid of this completely. It's nuanced, and there were different restrictions depending on what happened to your DEF system. But they're going to make it less draconian, and they're basically going to give you more time to fix the issue before it affects the truck. Now, there's different cases, like you run out of DEF, or your system's broken, or your system's not detected at all because people love to remove this thing. And basically, the EPA is going to come out with new regulations that still penalize you if your DEF system's not working, but it's much less. For example, a heavy duty pickup, you know, which is like a 350 or higher, they'll be limited to 45 miles an hour after 4,200 miles or 80 hours of driving without DEF. I still have a little bit of an issue with this. I mean, to me, it's a safety issue. If you're going to break someone's vehicle because they're not following some rule, I have a problem with that. I think there may be better ways to enforce that. Like, it's just what, like with on-road and off-road diesel fuel. Off-road diesel is clear, and it's meant for use in tractors and things like that. On-road diesel has a dye in it, and that shows that you have paid the proper taxes that help fund the highways and such. And if you are pulled over and they test your diesel and you don't have the dye in there, you get a huge fine. I feel like that's a better way of handling this, and they could do the same thing with DEF, but I don't know. The whole thing's frustrating. Anyway, I'm going to call that as potential good news here, because they're at least trying to improve the situation, which was just over the top draconian, in my opinion. I just have to mention this one piece of news that is one of several major news stories this week, so you've probably heard of it, but in Washington, D.C. right now, federal troops have taken to the streets, and one of the reasons they're there is to basically get rid of homeless people. And the way they're doing that is a little bit controversial, shall we completely understate it. They're basically going to say, move, or we're going to lock you up. Now, they're not presenting it that way. They're saying that if you don't move, we're going to enter you into a rehab program where we will provide housing, etc. But essentially, they're going to lock people up. And where they're going to put them could be described as a prison, could be described as a detention center. And if you think about this, these people aren't doing something because they want to. They're doing something because they have to. And we've talked about homelessness and the overlap with van life here quite a bit. The trend is continuing that homelessness is being seen more and more as a criminal activity in this country, and that is going to bleed over to van life. For example, if you go into DC right now and try to stealth camp in your van, you could have federal officers banging on your window. Now, I don't think the result is going to be any different currently. I think they're going to just tell you to move along, and being that you're in a van, you can do that, and that'll be the end of it. But this is an escalation, and I am not the biggest slippery slope kind of person, but this is looking like a pretty slippery slope. So I think that if you're the kind of person who travels in a van or other vehicle and you try to do stealth camping, you need to pay attention to this and just keep paying attention, because things are changing and not for the better. I am in the uncomfortable position of having to recommend folks stay in campgrounds as much as possible. I don't like campgrounds. I don't want to stay in campgrounds. But that does seem to be what we're being forced to do by all these regulations. So I'll have an Axios link in the show notes if you'd like to read more about it. But if you've listened to the news at all this week, you've probably heard about it. On a similar note, and this actually is from June, I was given a Substack article to look at, and you may remember A while back, we talked about BLM land being under attack in what was called the Big Beautiful Bill, and it was removed. Well, it's back. There's a Senator Mike Lee from Utah is still trying to sell off Bureau of Land Management land. And I don't know what his motivation is, but it is not in the public good, and it is certainly not in the good of us van life folks. Now, it's a much more restrictive sell-off. There's new requirements. It's limited to certain states, which is interesting. But again, BLM land is a treasure, especially for people like us. And folks are trying to sell it, and you're not going to get the money. You know, it's not like they're going to say, yeah, we're going to sell this land here and let's give everybody who is going to use it a check. No, that isn't how it works. Whatever that money is going to be used for, it isn't going to be for your benefit. At least I don't think so. So again, pay attention. And if you're in, I mean, the only people who would be able to do anything about this other than protesting or whatever would be people who live in Utah. And well, people in Utah may have a vested interest in not having this BLM land because they would be the ones who got the money. I don't know. It's very disappointing to me that public lands are being sold off, because throughout history, we have pretty much seen that whenever that happens, they never come back. The only time public land ever comes back is if private individuals buy it and donate it to the public. And then we could see it happen again. This has happened in Salem, Massachusetts, in a place called Heritage Park, which was a big area that I used to camp in, that they keep chipping away at it. And first it was just a golf course, and then they started building houses. And anyway, so a little bit of good news, some bad news, and all of it political. And I regret that, but that's the news. Tech Talk. This has been happening more and more often. And again, I have to thank John Hiker, because we've talked about this a bit, but we need to talk about polarity here. And I'm not talking about politics for once. No, this is polarity of DC circuits. So a DC circuit, direct current, has a positive wire and a negative wire, and that's it. DC is nice and simple, which is one of the reasons Edison was in favor of it, until Tesla showed that AC current was much better for different systems. But in vehicles, 12-volt nominal DC is still the norm, and it has been for a long time. It's also normal to have negative ground or negative earth, if you're not from the U.S., which meant that the hot wire would be the one that went to every device, and then the ground wire, the other wire, could go to the chassis or whatever. The only time that's ever been an issue for me was on Mack trucks, which used to be positive ground for some reason. And we had to put in a control module to switch that so that we could install radios and cell phones in them. Very odd choice on their behalf. But anyway, all that aside, when you buy things that are supposed to be put into a DC circuit, whether it's a fan or solar panels or LED lights or whatever, that polarity matters. And what I'm seeing more and more, and what John has seen several times now, is that the manufacturers are screwing it up. They're labeling things wrong, and this causes a problem. And it might be as simple as you hook up a fan and the blades turn backwards, if you had a very simple fan, or you could blow something up, or at least destroy it. So here's what you should always do, always. Every single time, and it's not that big of a deal, but you want to test the polarity of these things. Make sure the wiring is correct. How do you do that? Well, the easiest way is with a multimeter. And again, this is one of those things that everybody should have a multimeter. Some of them are very complex, and you look at these things and like, I'm never going to figure out how to use this. But you can. You can figure out how to use the parts you need. Because to test this, all you have to do is turn the knob or press the button. And it's usually for 50 volts. You'll see something there, 50 volts. And then there'll be a symbol that means DC, or it'll actually say DC. You set it to that. 50 volts DC is normally what it is. And then what comes out of the multimeter is two leads. Generally, one is going to be red and one is going to be black. Sidebar. Boy, do I love sidebars. In DC circuits, red usually means hot, and black usually means ground. In our world, in the van life world, which is an offshoot of the RV world, those conventions are out the window because a lot of times they're wired with AC wiring color codes, and there are places where they cross over. And so what I'm basically saying is you can't trust the color of any wire in your rig unless you put it there yourself. And if you bought somebody else's van, you absolutely can't trust it. My Tiki Bago, the guy apparently had a lot of red wire left over, and he ran the grounds with red wire, which caused me hours and hours of confusion until I finally got out the multimeter and tested things. And that's the point here. Have your multimeter handy. Learn how to test polarity. It's not hard. You touch the black lead to the black wire. You touch the red lead to the red wire or whatever color they are. And you look at the screen or the dial. If the polarity is correct, you will see a positive number, probably 12.7 volts or 13.5 volts or something like that. If the polarity is reversed, you will see a negative symbol in front of that. It'll see negative 13.5 or negative 12.7, and that means your polarity is reversed, or at least know what the wires are now. Label them. Put a sticker on there, write on there with a tiny Sharpie. Whatever you have to do, label them, and then you won't have all the problems you can have if you don't pay attention to polarity. The two big takeaways from this rambling I just did is test things with a multimeter. And number two, do not trust the manufacturer. I don't know what the heck is going on, but they're getting things wrong, and that's causing serious problems. In fact, that leads into the next piece here. Product review. Well, if you've listened to me for any time at all talk about solar panels, I have been very, very down on flexible panels. I've been just like, flexible panels. And for good reason. Flexible panels have a terrible reliability history. They produce less power. They're more expensive. There's a lot of reasons to go with a rigid panel if you can. But time passes, and then needs pass too. There are times when a flexible panel is the only thing that's going to work, or is the best thing that's going to work, and maybe you're willing to put up with all those things. Well, I decided to give flexible panels a try. I bought a flexible panel. It's a Bouge RV 200 watts monocrystalline panel. Monocrystalline just means how the crystals of the silica wafers are made. There's poly and mono. It used to matter. It doesn't really matter anymore, in my opinion. This is not a SIGS panel. This is not one of the more advanced ones. This is a, I don't know how many generations, but an evolved version of the first flexible panels. And I've had it now for a few weeks, and I have put this thing through the ringer. I have this truck camper, talked about that before. I decided I was going to put flat panels on the roof, and I haven't been able to get on the roof to put it on there. So I have the flat panel hooked up, got a 100 amp hour lithium battery in there. It's a very modest setup, but I've just been leaving this panel on the ground. Now, it's a pretty big panel. It's not huge, but it's probably 3x4. It's been laying on the ground. I had it hanging off bungee cords. It's had things fall on it. I've seen raccoon tracks on it because things have been walking on it. This has not been a well cared for panel, but it has worked. No, this thing, I'm using this with the crappiest $9 PWM solar controller because it was what I had. And it worked fine. It's keeping my battery charged, and I have that set up so that there's always some draw on the battery in the camper. And it's been fine. Now, these things cost relatively about $100 for 100 watts. So you're going to pay $1 a watt, basically. This is not the greatest deal in the world for solar. You can pay a lot less for rigid panels. But the benefits of flexible, well, there's two scenarios where I see that these are better. For one, when you put them on the roof, you're putting the minimum amount of height possible on the roof, which in some cases is good. And that's kind of what I was thinking with this truck camper. Because, well, when you put it on the truck, it's pretty high. It also reduces wind resistance, so it might help with a little bit of gas mileage. And it's just also easier. This is controversial, but you could use adhesives to attach it to the roof rather than drilling holes. I always recommend solar panels are attached by something physical. But if you're going to use adhesives, this is much, much, much better than trying to do that with rigid panels. Also, they're portable. So this thing is small enough that depending on how my van or truck camper or whatever was organized, this could be my portable panel. I wouldn't need to buy a ready-made portable panel, which is going to be a lot more expensive. I could use this thing. It just has MC4 connectors coming out of it. So, I mean, I could just have a Y connector in my system and just plug this in for extra solar. So I think that's a great thing too. And it definitely feels strong enough like it could handle that. Now, these things are flexible. They're not like paper. I'm not going to roll this up into a cone or anything like that. It's like maybe a piece of plexiglass. You know, it will flex and it will bend. I don't know that you could wrap it around like a 50-gallon drum without breaking it, but you could definitely bend it over, say, the front of a camper if you wanted to do that. Now, you have to keep in mind, too, that when you bend a panel, you are necessarily reducing the amount of optimum power it can produce. Every single cell on that panel needs to be facing the sun in order to get the most power. And if you bend it, it's physically not possible for that to happen. So just want to mention that. At any rate, so far, this thing has been great. I love it. It was a little bit more expensive than my other panels, but it's been a heck of a lot easier to deal with. And when I do finally mount it, it's going to be a much simpler procedure than if I had to mount rigid panels. However, there's two things to know about these things. Traditionally, the problem with flexible panels has been longevity. They don't like heat. They get very, very hot. It's really hard to ventilate underneath them because of the way they are. They want to be flat, sit on the roof. And what I'm reading from reviews of other people, this is not something that happened to me, is they screw up the polarity at the factory. Sometimes the MC4 cables are wrong. They use the red one for negative and the black one for positive. So again, check your polarity. However, I will now have to be on the record as somebody who has a flexible panel and likes it. And that is a change from, say, 3 years ago when I was very, very much against flexible panels. I will let you know how this goes on, but I have a link in the show notes. It's about $212 for this 200-watt panel I have. They also have 100-watt panels, which are cheaper per watt, but then you got to buy more cables and there's more complexity. So I chose to go this route. And, you know, 200 watts to charge a 100-amp-hour solar, 100-amp-hour lithium battery is a pretty good match. I think I'm going to be in good shape. So link in the show notes. And, quick note, Bougie RV has given me free products in the past, like a refrigerator. This is not one of those. I bought this with my own money, and I'm not being influenced by them at all. Dales from the road. Okay, so more tales about the truck camper. Again, my life has been very complex. I've been traveling a lot. And this weekend, I finally made time to work on the truck camper. I'm ready to finish it. I've already done some work. The weather was going to be okay. I bought a gigantic fan, a barn fan, so I can have that on while I'm working on it. And everything's great. And I finally got up, grabbed my coffee, went out, opened the door, got into the truck camper, which is a considerably difficult thing the way I have it off the truck right now and way up high in the air. And I saw something move. Like, okay, what's that? Something's in here. A rat, a mouse, a squirrel, a chipmunk. And then I got a good look at it. And no, it was a wren. It was a house wren, which is a fairly common bird we have around here. Very cute little, very loud bird. But okay, the bird had gotten in the camper. This is not impossible to believe because, again, the wings of the camper, the floors of the wings are open because that's where the rotten wood was. I did have them covered up, but I removed those covers when I thought I was going to work on this last week, but I never actually got to work on it. Anyway, okay, big deal, right? There's a bird in the thing. I'll just let it out. And so I'm like, okay, let's see. I want to open the door and I want to give it only one path out. And then I go to the window and I'm like, what is that? And I look on the window. Now, this truck camper is a traditional RV. Above the window, there's a valance, you know, a piece of fabric that wraps around the top of the window. And it's covered in moss. It's not like the moss is growing there. It's that the moss is like gathered. Something grabbed the moss and stuck it there and then kind of stuck it together with spider webs. And it's just this massive thing on top of the valance. And I'm like, oh, that's a nest. The wren made a nest. And I was like, ah, all right. Sorry, Ren, you're going to have to start over because I need to work on my camper van. So I go over to the nest and it has eggs in it. Yeah, I could see three eggs in there. So this wren has moved into my truck camper and set up housekeeping, and that housekeeping includes at least three eggs. And now I've got a problem. My problem is on many levels. Some of you may be thinking, well, what's the problem? Just remove the nest. Problem solved. Sure, I could do that, but I'm not going to do that. That thought never occurred to me. Once I saw those eggs, that's it. This has got to stay here until those eggs hatch. And so that's just my inclination. That's the first problem. The second one is, if my wife ever found out that I removed that nest, I would be in serious, serious trouble. So that's not going to happen. And number three, it's illegal. Yeah, in the U.S., it is illegal to remove a nest, except under certain circumstances. And there are protected species and unprotected species, but wrens are protected species. Now, yeah, of course, I could remove this and nobody would ever find out. Of course. But there is no way to remove a nest with eggs in it, in this situation anyway, to someplace safer and have the mother find it. I mean, I have a house. I have a birdhouse set up. It's set up for wrens. It's sized for wrens. We've had wrens living in it. I technically could take this nest and put it in that box, but how would the mother know it was there? So it has to stay. Okay, well, I've got a bird in the camper. I've got a nest in the camper. Having had birds in vehicles before, that's not a great thing. They tend to make a mess. So how do I solve all these different problems I have? Well, the first thing I have to do is accept the fact that I'm not going to be able to fix this camper for probably 2 months. That's a bitter, bitter, bitter pill to swallow. So I have to do that first. The second is I have to make it so that the damage to the camper will be minimized, but not in a way that will restrict the mother's access to the nest. And so what I ended up doing was I took a tarp and wrapped it around where the nest is and the bench seat that is missing, which is basically a hole to the outside underneath it. That was how the mother was getting in, and she has complete access to the nest there. So I put that tarp up, opened the door, and I slid the curtain across the bed so that there was a little way out, but that's it. And then I left. Now, I didn't see this happen, but I know that the mother left at some point. And then later that evening, I looked around. It didn't look like there was anyone home, so I shut the door. And now we wait. And so I made a contract with the wren. Not that the wren knew this, but the contract was this. Wren, if I see you tending to that nest, you can stay in my truck camper for 2 months. And if I don't see you, if I don't see any activity at all, this coming weekend, I'm going to remove nest and the eggs are going to be left out for the raccoons because that's the best I could think to do with them. And I didn't see anything. So I put a ring camera in there, actually. I call it the Wren Cam. I put a ring camera in there and it shoots up at the nest. And I don't have a clear view of the nest. It's not like I can see inside the nest. But the ring camera detects motion. So if anything happens in there, I will find out about it. And that's all I really care about. I'm not trying to do a science experiment. Because if I did set up like a really cool little camera where you can see the babies and all this, I would be disturbing the area. And that is likely to drive the mother away, which I don't want. So I just very quickly hid this little ring camera in, not even close to the nest, but where you could see it. But then all evening yesterday and all night last night, nothing, no motion. And I'm like, well, either the mother didn't come back or the mother's actually in the nest and I can't see her. So I don't know which, but boop, this morning I get an alert and I look and there's the mother. She flew in and she definitely is in the nest tending the eggs. So, okay, Mama Wren, enjoy your truck camper. I am going to figure something else out. I have to be in Colorado in the middle of next month for a camping trip. And I, even though I own four RVs, I can't use any of them for different reasons. And I am not a religious person, but if I was, I would think someone was trying to tell me something. But I've never listened to things, so I will be in Colorado. I just have to figure out how, and I think I have an idea that I will talk about in the future. So anyway, yeah, my truck camper is being put to use, and it will continue to do so until those chicks fledge, at which point I will continue building or rebuilding the thing, I hope. A place to visit. One of my favorite things to do when I go to a place is to just spend some time, an hour or two, whatever I can spare in the schedule, and just wander around. And I did that in Sydney, Australia, the last time I was there, which is 10 years ago now, which is sad. But I was right in Sydney at a hotel right in Sydney. I went out the door and just started walking generally downhill, and I ended up at Hyde Park. Now, Hyde Park, if you're from Sydney, if you've ever been to Sydney, you probably know of Hyde Park. It's this huge park in the middle of Sydney, and it's famous for having cockatoos in the trees, which for someone from North America is very strange. You're walking in the park and, you know, you might see some pigeons or some crows or some blue jays, but no. There's cockatoos in the tree making their weird noises, and there's lots of them, and it's just completely normal. It's a little jarring. And it's also pretty cool. I mean, this park is beautiful, big, tall trees, just a really, really nice place to be. But I wanted to talk specifically about something I found in the park that I didn't know was there. And that is the ANZAC Memorial. So ANZAC stands for Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. Everyone calls them ANZAC. ANZAC is a very common term that people would know down there. And it's just, you know, it's their army, it's their military. But they're a Commonwealth country, so this army in the past was controlled by Great Britain or the UK. And if you've ever seen the movie Gallipoli, or you've ever done any research into the Commonwealth countries during World War II, these folks fought very valiantly in very, very difficult circumstances. And there's sometimes a little bit of resentment as to how they were used by the UK. Now, my family comes from Newfoundland, and the Blue Puttee was similar. And I actually have a relative who was killed in World War I at the age of 19 in a similar situation to what ANZAC went through. And so I get that. But okay, so there's a memorial to this. So a lot of parks have war memorials and stuff, but this one was somehow different. It's this building that you go in, and when you get in there, it's not a museum, it's a memorial. So it's all very, very solid, you know, it's marbles, it's granite, very solid structure. And when you go in, there's a person there, which was very helpful to me because I got to ask them questions. And then there's a well. Now, when I say a well, it's like a well, it's an architectural well, like in a gallery. It's not like where you'd get water. It's this round space with a railing that you can lean over. And then there's this big area that below. If you're an Indiana Jones fan, you might think of the Well of Souls. It's not quite that. But in the well, there were stars. Not lights, gold stars that were actually on pieces of paper. And the floor, they were just on the floor. They weren't on the floor upstairs. They were only in this well. And I thought that was odd. And I went over and asked the person who was basically a park ranger, and, you know, what's up? And he explained that those were memory stars put there by people who had lost somebody in the wars that ANZAC was brought into. And it was just very touching. This is a quiet place, a place of reflection. And, well, there's just a lot of thoughts to have about people being sent to war, not necessarily against their will. This wasn't necessarily a draft situation. I know that my great uncle wasn't drafted. He signed up gladly. But they went to war not for their own country necessarily, but for the country that their country was beholden to. And then they were treated like well, these are lesser troops, so we're going to send them to the front, if you know what I mean. I'm not trying to get too controversial here or to express opinions that I am not allowed to have because this is not my situation, but that's kind of how it was. And if you see the movie Gallipoli, you get a sense of that. These folks are very proud of that service. It was a service of loyalty. It was a service of dedication and self-sacrifice. And it was a service for the greater good as they saw it. And I don't think history disagrees with that. I think the Allied efforts in World War I and World War II were actually on the right side of that conflict. The reason I'm telling you about this is that that was a very nice and impactful day. And I've been all over the world. I've seen a great many things. But that day, that walk through Hyde Park and that walk to the Anzac Memorial has stuck with me, which means it has some meaning. And it might have some meaning for you. So if you're in Sydney and you have an hour or two, have a stroll in Hyde Park and take some time to reflect at the Anzac Memorial and understand what had to happen in order for that memorial to be there. And I'm not talking about raising the money for the memorial. I'm talking about historically what had to happen for an effort to be made to make such a place. And don't forget to learn what Anzac cookies are. Resource recommendation. Really quick, if you're interested in the digital nomad stuff, there's a website that's pretty much the website. It's called Citizen Remote, which is kind of self-explanatory. CitizenRemote.com is a pretty well-established website, and their tagline is work remotely, live globally, and they have resources for all kinds of different places where you can go and be a digital nomad. They actually have reviews. They've got a star system. They can talk about visas and things like that. And it's well worth giving them a look. They can help with the visa process. And while most of the site is free, there is a paid tier where you get more things, of course. And it's probably worth it if you're actually seriously considering being a digital nomad. It's probably worth, you know, diving in here some more, because it would be much better to find out problems before you went than now. And they've got social media. They've got, you can connect with expats and talk to them. They have a blog and a journal and stuff like that. And they're actually working on a dating service, apparently. And they're going to be doing events as well. But those things are coming. So they actually have really good resources, including like on insurance. One of the biggest issues that if I were going to do this, which I can't, but if I were going to do this, I would be very, very concerned about that. So if you are interested in exploring the digital nomad phenomenon, absolutely, you need to check out citizenremote.com and see what they have to offer, because it might be just what you're looking for. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 268. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And if you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am at jeff@builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember this surprisingly deep Irish proverb. May your home always be too small to hold all of your friends.